From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. An apprentice can learn career skills without taking on student debt. Apprenticeships have been concentrated in the building trades, but there's a move now to create more apprenticeships in non-traditional careers, like cybersecurity and healthcare. We talked to Maryland's labor secretary and a workforce developer from Washington State. Then, Marian Palaya has set her first novel, The Given World, in America after the Vietnam War. Tom Hall and Palaya discuss the meaning of home and her character's search to find it. Plus, spoken word artist Bilfina Yawan came to America from Liberia as a refugee when she was 7 years old. She talks with Tom about the cultural challenges of growing up African in America. Now the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning, it's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Just under 8,000 workers in Maryland are learning their trade or profession as apprentices, and 85% of those apprentices are learning a construction trade like electrician or mason. Those statistics mirror the national picture. Across the U.S., there are relatively few apprenticeships, and they are heavily concentrated in unionized building trades. That picture may be changing in Maryland and across the country. There's a renewed interest in a system, common in Europe, that helps workers earn while they learn new skills and enter their career without a load of student debt. And businesses that have not used apprenticeships before are testing whether it can help them create a workforce with the skills business needs. Those are topics that will be discussed at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions when it kicks off its national convention in Baltimore today. With me in the studio is Susan Crane, Executive Director of Skill Up Washington in Seattle, a collaborative that connects employers, low-income adults, and post-secondary training. She's chairing a panel about apprenticeships at the National Conference. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also with me is Maryland's new Labor Secretary, Kelly Schultz, who heads Maryland's Department of Labor Licensing and Regulation, DLLR. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So, Secretary Schultz, give us the simplest, briefest definition of what an apprenticeship is.
Well, I think you said it very clearly when you opened, and you said it's earning while you learn. And I think that the most important thing is to be able to create a constituency in a workforce of individuals that are learning a trade, learning a profession as they're earning money, and being able to create opportunities for themselves within industries that have provided those opportunities.
But what does an apprentice have at the end of the process besides a hearty handshake? Is there something they can show to another employer? And
certified.
Say, what I know?
They can be certified and they can be licensed. And if it's an occupation that is a licensed occupation within the within our department, DLLR, that gives them the opportunity to move forward with either an apprenticeship license leading to a journeyman's license in some cases and a master's license, particularly in one of the fields is if you, which you had mentioned, which is the electricians. And that's probably our most vast apprenticeship program right now currently within the trades. Mm-hmm. The other thing that they come out of is not just that physical certification, but they come out with an education. They actually come out with a skill where it's transferable to their industry and to many businesses in the area.
And why do you think there are so few apprenticeships now?
I don't think we've focused on apprenticeships as much as we have perhaps in the past. And I think that it's cyclical. You look at the economy and you look at the jobs and the economic viability that's out there. I don't think it's dramatically different, obviously, in Maryland than it is across the country. And so we want to make sure that we emphasize. So when we look at the overall idea of apprenticeships, it's been very focused within the skilled trades and within certain specific skilled trade associations. And what we're doing now, and I know that they're working on this nationwide as well, and I know that the U.S. Department of Labor is also looking at it, is different types of apprenticeship programs, which may not be the traditional apprenticeship programs which we had in the past.
Right. Susan Crane, the Federal Labor Department is trying to jumpstart apprenticeships in the U.S. How?
Well, one of the ways that the federal Labor Department is doing that is it put $100 million on the street for an RFP, and that generated an incredible amount of interest in apprenticeship. As an apprenticeship geek, that nobody really wanted to know about that in the past. Suddenly, my phone's been ringing off the hook because there are people all over the country who are wanting to start apprenticeship programs, and that's very exciting.
Secretary Shultz, DLLR has submitted an application for one of these DOL grants to create apprenticeships an apprenticeship in cybersecurity.
Yes, we have.
Describe to me what kind of jobs we'd be talking about.
Well, obviously, cybersecurity is a great buzzword, and the state of Maryland has really been on the forefront of cybersecurity education with our higher education institutes here and a good amount of innovation centers across that with the military and some of the intelligence agencies that are focused right here in Maryland. It's obviously something where we have a natural workforce, where we have people in an industry that could require skills based on cybersecurity. So we're talking about analytical skills. We're talking about, obviously, IT skills, innovative thinking skills, and all of those would come together under what we have put forward as an apprenticeship program for this industry that had come to us saying that they needed a trained workforce because it's a relatively new industry throughout not only this country but the world. We all know what has happened as far as securing our computer systems, securing the data, and there's no higher need than what we have seen we need in the federal government moving forward in order to be able to secure our data and the information of our citizens.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Kelly Shultz, Secretary of Maryland's Department of Labor, Licensing and Regulation, DLLR, and with Susan Crane, Executive Director of Skill Up Washington in Seattle. We're talking about a resurgence in interest in apprenticeships. Secretary Shultz, how much is the interest in apprenticeship fueled by getting employment for Marylanders who have been hard to employ? People with low skills, people who missed getting skills in school.
Well, I think that in our traditional apprenticeship programs, I think that has been a focus. When you look at the educational system with the Maryland State Department of Education, where we stand right now, there has not been a huge focus on looking at students that have not necessarily been in the college-ready track. So if you go to a Maryland public school, you are put into a couple of different types of tracks. And it's been, I think, wanting for some redirection when it comes to those students that may not want to go to the college-ready track. And so what types of skills are we supplying with them at the public school level after they graduate from high school? Are there specific apprenticeship programs or specific type of skills that they are going to be prepared for on day one of graduation? And that's where the Maryland State Legislature stepped in last year, this past legislative session, and developed through the Augustine Commission a youth apprenticeship program, which quite frankly addresses that issue of what we do to be able to supply skills so that when a high school graduate leaves high school and they're not going to college, what are they able to do on day one of graduation? And this bill will allow us to develop a pilot program in two school districts that will allow the students starting at the age of 16 the opportunity to earn while they learn and also develop skills while they're getting their credentials for a high school education. And so they're going to be able to gain apprenticeship hours and credits within high school. And then on the day that they leave high school, they will have that step up within an apprenticeship program that's been approved by a youth advisory council.
Another group in Maryland that's applying for one of the Department of Labor grants is the Baltimore Alliance for Careers in Healthcare, or BAC, a partnership that includes seven hospitals. Executive Director Laura Spada told me they want to make an apprenticeship that would let, say, a hospital housekeeper build the skills to become a certified nursing assistant and then perhaps move on to other jobs.
Every job title has a set of tasks. And sitting down with the employer, we will identify those competencies that are essential to each of the steps along the way of the apprenticeship program. And when an individual can do all the competencies that are identified with that particular skill area with no supervision, then they're ready to move on.
Susan, is that unusual to be judging by competency rather than a certain number of hours on the job, a certain number of hours of training in a classroom?
So that is newer within the apprenticeship model. The apprenticeship model in the United States has tended to be more of that old-fashioned model, and we are catching up with Europe and Australia and Canada at this point.
Well, we've talked about healthcare apprenticeships. We've talked about cybersecurity, mm-hmm. which is certainly new. What are some other what would be innovative in America apprenticeships that are on the horizon?
Well, some of them, and this is one that I would love to see happen, is that government ought to walk the talk. And so when we've been talking in Seattle about what to do and what to do with the, you know, because this is a unionized environment, is how do we create non-traditional apprenticeships, for example, for an accounting track? If you look at government, you have people who start as accounting clerks and they can move all the way up. There's no reason why that actually can't become a real foundation for apprenticeship
in
itself.
The private sector.
It's like we ourselves in the public sector, mm-hmm. we ourselves need to mirror that behavior.
So you're talking about government apprenticeships.
That's right.
But you just described to me that accountants already move up through government.
Not necessarily.
What more is it?
It's not as consistently applied. It's more something that is, I see someone who is doing really well, I might help get that person to the next step. But if you actually have an apprenticeship and you have that all articulated, you really have a way to move people up that's systematic as opposed to something that happens for some people and not for others.
And if we look at that and how that affects the overall operations of a government entity, you look at secession rates and mm-hmm. you get people within government agencies and within the bureaucratic nature, and it tends to be an aging population. I know it is in the state of Maryland, and I'm sure nationwide it's the same. So to be able to create apprenticeships and to be able to create those opportunities where you have a natural succession and a plan for that would also help the continuity of the government operations.
The other thing that that Kelly was talking about that is really interesting is that if you start with youth apprenticeships, which they do in Europe and Canada and everywhere else but us for the most part, is
and as Kelly pointed out, that Maryland is now trying to catch up.
That's right. We all are, and you folks are ahead in some ways. That what happens for an employer is that the employer, by paying taxes, is getting some of that classroom training that the apprentice needs while the apprentice is in high school. That's a good deal for an employer. It's also a really good deal for the individual.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Kelly Schultz is Secretary of Maryland's Department of Labor, Licensing, and Regulation, DLLR. Susan Crane is Executive Director of Skill Up Washington in Seattle. She'll be leading a discussion, Can Apprenticeships Work for You?, at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions Conference here in Baltimore tomorrow. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. And we've got more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.
Thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. And my guest this morning is the author Marion Palaya. She spent some time in Kensington, Maryland as a teenager before adventures that took her to Montana, Hong Kong, Vietnam, and Nepal. She lives in San Francisco now, and she'll be in Baltimore next week to talk about her debut novel, The Given World. We meet its protagonist, Riley, as a teenage girl in Montana in 1968, a chaotic and difficult time in America. The novel is a masterful rumination on the meaning of home, the bonds of family, and the many ways in which different people come of age. Marion Palaya joins me this morning on the line from KQED in San Francisco. It's good to talk to you.
You too, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And I really, really enjoyed this novel. I really, really liked it a lot. So thanks for the novel. Tell us a little bit about Riley. At one point, she talks about the all-too-familiar duality of rootless and pointless. Riley's had some tough times in her life.
Well, she's a pretty fairly normal kid when she's young, but her brother is sort of the center of her universe. And when he goes off to Vietnam and they lose him in a tunnel, she sort of comes apart. So yeah, that rootless and pointless line was, I mean, it was a culmination of what had happened with her brother and then all the things that she did following that. She had sort of a wild life and she was trying to figure out where she was going and what she was doing and I guess where home was and what the point was. So that was Riley.
Yeah.
She was.
And when you say that they lost her brother, I mean, literally, they were not able to find his body. It's assumed that he was killed in the war. But what happened to the brother as far as we know?
Well, he was a tunnel rat. And as you probably know, those are the guys that, the little guys, and he was a little guy that went into the tunnels with, you know, the end of a bayonet and a flashlight and maybe a revolver. And the tunnel system in Kuchi was pretty substantial. He went in one day and he never came out. And around that time, we also started carpet bombing the tunnels, and so they collapsed. And anyway, they couldn't find him, so they didn't know what had happened to him until many, many years later.
And Riley goes to Vietnam, putatively, I guess, to look for him, right? But she spends a fair amount of time there. The book begins with her in Vietnam as a much older person than the story begins. She's an adult by the time she's in Vietnam. She's in San Francisco for a while. She's in Montana for a while. So she gets around in this novel. But when she goes to Vietnam, what do you think she's attempting to do?
I think she just wanted to go to the place where he was last seen. I guess she's just really a wanderer. I don't know. Who knows what compels people to do what they do? I suppose I should know since she's my character. When I started writing the book, I wrote that chapter first, and it really was just a scene set in a bar in Saigon, and then it grew into this beast of a novel. I guess what she was doing there was really sort of what I was doing there, was just exploring the territory and seeing, you know, what was this thing that we all know of one way as Vietnam, and that the Vietnamese, of course, know as a completely different thing.
And when you started the novel with that scene in the bar in Saigon, did you have a pretty acute and specific understanding of how this story was going to unfold? Or is your style as a writer that, you know, do you just sort of start writing a chapter and see where the character leads you?
That's exactly what I do. It's sort of, you know, the metaphor is it's sort of going into that dark tunnel myself. And I never really know what people are going to do until they do it. I mean, I have a little bit of premeditation occasionally, but I really didn't know. I mean, I knew the basic story when I started writing that about the brother.
And is Riley based on your own life? I mean, a lot of folks, especially in their first novel, and this is a debut novel for you, do mine heavily from their own personal experience. You were in the Peace Corps in Nepal. You did spend, as you mentioned, some time in Vietnam. Did you rely heavily on your own personal experience to create this character of Riley?
I did. I'd say probably about two-thirds of the book are pretty close to experiences that I've had or people, you know, or things that I've seen happen. I worked, a lot of the middle part of the book is set in San Francisco, and I've lived here for 15 years before I went away, and then I've just come back in the last few years. And the bar scenes are very, you know, those are people that I knew, most of whom did not survive because of bad living, basically. So yeah, a lot of it is very close to the truth.
I mean, there are a number of really fascinating characters, all of whom are really quite intriguing and likable, but many of them, including Riley, exhibit some fairly self-destructive behavior. It's not just her, but it's this sort of large cohort of friends and lovers. Were you trying to sort of study the tension between what happens when you bring some problems on yourself and when problems confront you, or you're confronted with problems of other people's makings? Was that part of your intention when you're writing this book?
Not consciously. I think I sort of wrote it one story at a time. It's very episodic. And really, I just was writing scenes, and I didn't really think about, you know, the overarching, you know, thematic issues of it. Really, I felt like, well, my job was just to put these people on the page and, you know, and tell a story in each chapter.
Have some of the folks who did survive those sort of wild times in the 70s and 80s in San Francisco, have they read the book and given you feedback about it?
Indeed, they have. Mostly good. I haven't gotten any grief from it yet. I think, you know, the people, and they really are people from this one particular saloon.
So what were you doing in the saloon? You were working as a barkeep there?
I worked as a bartender there for almost 16 years. I got that job 2 weeks before I turned 30. I had just moved to San Francisco, and it really was a very formative experience. And I knew nothing. I was very ignorant about the world and many things. And I really got an education in that bar. It's a wonderful place, and it's still going strong. But not all the patrons, as I said, made it through the. Basically, the 70s and 80s were pretty wild times in the city.
San Francisco is one of the places where the novel takes place, but also the character of Montana is really quite beautifully etched, as is the character of Vietnam. I mean, the importance of place in all of the different scenes in this novel seems to be pretty high to me. Were you conscious of that?
Oh, absolutely. I worked really, really hard on that. The Vietnam, I haven't been back to Vietnam. I lived there for a year in 1994, and it really is very embedded in my brain. And I've been back a few times, but most of that just came from my early memories of being there then. I can't believe it was 20 years ago. And then Montana is a place that I've lived on and off since the early 80s. But where Riley is from is north central Montana, and that's a long way from Missoula, which is where I've lived. And I did have to go and really research that. I got a small grant from the University of Wisconsin to go drive around Montana for a couple of weeks, and I was sort of like, oh, don't throw me in the briar patch, because it was really a wonderful thing to be able to just do this and say and call it work. So I did a lot of exploring, and, you know, around the reservations and the Little Rockies, and it's, yeah, place is incredibly important in my work and all of it.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Marian Palaya joins me on the line from San Francisco. We're talking about her debut novel, The Given World. A lot of folks advise writers, you know, to write what you know, and you have certainly done this based on, you know, as you've said, your personal experience. What does that mean for the next book? Do you keep mining your own personal experience, or is this something that is this kind of cathartic? Have you gotten this out of your system, and now you're going to move on to other things?
Yeah, I think I've gotten the, you know, I mean, there's some bad behavior in the new book, but it's of a different sort. It's called the Hello Kitty Justice League, and the Hello Kitty Justice League is two women in Montana who are actually fighting, you know, sort of fighting the bad guys. This is just one part of many of the book, but they're burning down meth labs in the mountains outside of Missoula. So it's sort of Thelma and Louise meets Breaking Bad, and it's very different. I mean, the writing is the same. My voice probably will always be the same in my writing, but the story is quite a lot different.
And you've been writing for, you know, a number of decades, but this is your mm-hmm. first book. So how did this particular book come together? How did you get this published? You got Simon & Schuster, a big, you know, mainstream publisher.
I was doing my MFA. I went back to do my MFA at Madison in 2010 because I was hating my life because I wasn't writing, and I just thought, well, if not now, when?
This is while you're working as a bartender in San Francisco?
No, I actually was back in Montana, and I was working at the university there, and, you know, and I had a nice secure job running an AmeriCorps program, and it was a great office, and I loved the people I worked with, but I just really hated my life, and it was because I wasn't writing, so. It was time, so I went off to Madison and worked with Laurie Moore and some other great, great writers there. And I'd always been a short story writer, and this book, you know, grew out of a single short story. And I just fooled myself into writing it by telling myself I was just writing a series of connected short stories. And a visiting writer read one of the chapters, and she loved it. And she said, you need to send this to my agent. So I did. It wasn't the easiest road in the world to align it as a novel after all that. But once that got done, that took another 2 years after I graduated.
Did you get a lot of help? I mean, was an editor, you know, did the editor in this particular instance play a big role?
No, we didn't have an editor yet. This was just me and my agent, and so it was mostly me. And it went through three or four really very serious revisions, and it finally was complete in the summer of 2013, and we sent it out that fall, and it was sold within a week of her sending it out. We had 12 editors that called and said, yes, I want this book.
Well, I can understand why they were attracted to it, because I certainly was.
Thank you.
So good luck with it, and good luck with the next one as well, and it's good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
All right, you too, Tom. Thanks so much.
Marion Palaya, her debut novel is called The Given World. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You can meet Marion Palaya next Wednesday night when she'll read from her new novel at Atomic Books in Hamden. We'll have a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. There's lots more ahead on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Stay with us.
Issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover, let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Saturday is World Refugee Day, and the Creative Alliance is going to use it as an opportunity to shine a spotlight on some of the talented refugee and immigrant artists who currently live in Baltimore. The World Refugee Day Street Festival starts at noon on Saturday in East Baltimore. There'll be music, dance, food, crafts, and all that kind of stuff. And joining me in the studio is a woman who will be one of the featured performers at the festival. Bilfina Yuan is a spoken word artist and a refugee from West Africa. I'm so delighted to meet you. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
And welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us about your story. Where were you born? You were born in Liberia, lived a little bit in Côte d'Ivoire, and then moved to the U.S. when?
I moved to the U.S. in 2001. So my airplane actually landed in New York my first time seeing snow because I came in January. And then I moved to Virginia, and that's where I stayed for quite a bit of time before moving to Baltimore.
So in 2001, how old were you?
I was about seven, going on eight, yes.
And why did your family decide to leave Africa and come to U.S.?
There was the Second World War was happening. I was born during the Second World War, and a lot of conflicts was happening as a result of that. Also, my grandfather, who is actually an activist, he is a writer. At the time, he was speaking against the government because he felt that the government was committing crimes against the people, and he felt the people were suffering as a result. And so he spoke against the government and basically said, you know, you can't continue to do this to our people. And as a result of him advocating for human rights, essentially, he was targeted by the government, and he came to the United States. But because we were left behind, he felt that we were in danger, and war was starting to happen in Ivory Coast, and so we came to the country as refugee.
And what was your experience as a little kid? I mean, you're 7 years old. What's that like?
I mean, I think our families did a great job to keep our life kind of regular and make sure that we weren't too impacted by what was happening around us. Of course, you heard stories and you saw things, but I think that's why I advocate so much for human rights now, seeing that something as little as speaking up can put your life in danger, essentially.
Sure. And your experience as a child, you know, sort of incorporating yourself into American culture. I mean, I think white people, for example, have a natural assumption that Africans and African Americans will have an instant bond, an instant connection. Was that the case for you and for many of the other folks you know in the refugee community?
Actually, no. One, you're coming to a whole nother culture. You know, the weather is different, the food is different, the language sometimes is different. But even within the African and African American community, there's a lot of conflict there, where a lot of times there's this conflict of who's the true African, or I'm not African and you're Black, and things like that. And even the culture within African and African Americans are different. I tell my friends a lot back home, I'm Liberian, or I go by whatever ethnic group I identify by. Nobody really back home says, you know, oh, I'm Black. It's kind of like, what ethnic group are you, or where are you from? And so getting used to the responsibilities that came with my Blackness when I came to the United States, and then trying to adapt to the culture, it was a pretty big shift for
me. Yeah, I bet. Yeah. You know, what were your parents, I mean, you were a little kid when you came here, but when you grew up, what were your parents' view of African Americans? I mean, as Africans, you know, living outside of the U.S.?
Well, back home, we didn't really talk much about it. But, I mean, coming here, of course, the stereotypes of, you know, Black Americans are lazy, or Black Americans don't really do what they're supposed to do, or they get in trouble, that was very much so applied. And so a lot of times, a lot of Africans would tell you that their parents say, you know, don't do this, like, you know, Black kids. But I think it comes from a place of more so ignorance and years of being told that this is how you're supposed. So it's respectability politics, essentially. And so a lot of Africans kind of have fallen victim to playing respectability politics and against Black Americans. And so I think it's a matter of, I think when my family finally came to the U.S. and realized now that we're in the U.S., we are considered Black people, I think that they begin to see things a little more differently.
When you think about the immigrant experience, and you think about, you know, becoming part of the fabric of the United States, do you think about it in racial terms? Do you think, oh, I need to become part of Black America? Do I need to become part of white America? Do I need to, you know, juggle between the two? I mean, what does the notion of America mean to you as a Liberian who lived in the Ivory Coast?
Well, I think when I first came to the U.S., it was more so I just need to be an American, you know, whatever comes with being an American, hopes and dreams and all of that. But the more I started realizing that, you know, my Blackness does play a big part in how my American experience is going to be, I think I'm more so you know, became to identify more like I am a Black woman in America. But at the same time, I have other identities. I'm African, you know, and I have my ethnic identity. So I think I'm more so juggling between my African identities and my Black identity. I don't think I was like, I'm going to be this and this. It's more so trying to incorporate all of my identities in one, but still understanding that my race does and my gender plays a very big part in my role within American society.
You are a spoken word artist, and you're going to be performing on Saturday near the Creative Alliance. Can you give us a sample?
Yeah. So I'm going to do a piece that I wrote, and it's called When the Enemy Comes. When the enemy comes, bathe your daughters in spices. Hide razor blades between their thighs. Lay bullets underneath their tongues. Set their wombs on fire. When the enemy comes, rub the feces of your cattle in the mouths of your daughters. Let them chant spells into their nostrils, leaving their attackers repulsed. When the enemy comes, and the men are ready to make sacrifices out of the bodies of our girls, teach them to hide their necks under water, to tie their breasts flat, to shave their heads. Prepare your daughters for when the enemy comes.
And that was written in response to the Boko Haram abduction of the schoolgirls in Nigeria
yes.
a year ago. Yeah.
Yes, I wrote that literally after finding out. I had so many emotions, and that was kind of my way of writing it. I think the issue of gender is a big issue within all societies, but especially within the African society, the way girls and women are treated, you know, and it's very important. I think during times of war, the first people that are targeted are usually the women because they're raped, and it's a sign of reconquering, you know, this area. And so that poem was in response to that situation and a whole bunch of other situations.
And you've also been working with something called the Refugee Youth Project at the Baltimore City Community College. What has that experience been like?
I love it. So I've been working with the Refugee Youth Project since my sophomore year of college. And it was just instant. I mean, I'm a former refugee, and a lot of the students I work with are high school students, and they're preparing to transition to college. And they're going through a lot of the things that I went through, whether it's what is truly my identity, where do I fit in, and all of those things. And I think that, you know, I've really enjoyed being able to offer them advice, not based on what I think, but what I've experienced.
Spoken word artist Bilfina Yuan. She'll be performing at the World Refugee Day Street Festival on Saturday. It's from noon to 3 on Conklin Street in East Baltimore. The event is produced by the Creative Alliance, Baltimore Resettlement Center, International Rescue Committee, and the Baltimore City Community College Refugee Youth Project. We've got links to information about the festival and to Bilfina Yuan's website at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. It's been great meeting you and to check out your stuff on YouTube, and I encourage all of our listeners to do that as well, and have a good time on Saturday.
Thank you so much.
It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up Friday, Sheila visits Governor Larry Hogan's father, and I'll speak with a television historian who chronicles the parallels between high art and the early days of the tube. I hope you can join us Friday morning right here on 88.1. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Mary Wiltenberg,
Christy Forrest,
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1960, 12 Black students were refused service in Hooper's Restaurant in downtown Baltimore. They refused to leave, were arrested, convicted of criminal trespass, and fined. The NAACP sued to have the convictions dropped. Maryland's highest court, the Court of Appeals, upheld the convictions. But in 1964, after the U.S. Supreme Court sent it back to them, the Court of Appeals reversed them. Among the dozen youth, Robert M. Bell, who would become the first Black chief judge of Maryland's highest court in 1991. We're back Friday. Please join us.